Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. Today, our guest is Meredith Bergman. She's an American sculptor who creates both public monuments and works on a private scale. Let's start by taking just a moment, and Meredith, can you tell us just a little bit about what you do?
Well, I often do large public outdoor sculptures when I can get commissions to do them, because they're often about deeply thrilling and exciting themes, and they can have a very powerful impact on people. But I also like to do pieces that just come out of my own needs or urges or thoughts.
I think the biggest thing you've worked on is the Boston Women's Memorial. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That's the biggest one to date. It's three slightly larger than life bronze statues of women shown as having come down off their pedestals. So the big granite pedestals are part of the sculpture, and they're using them as desks.
And there's really a theme there, I think. So you've done that, the Boston Women's Memorial. You've sculpted the FDR Hope Memorial for Roosevelt Island. Here, if you know New York City, you know Roosevelt Island. It's in progress. You're working on it. There's the Rosa Parks sculpture, the 9/11 Memorial at the Cathedral of St. John. And if we were to tie these together, they seem to all have to do with history, race, human rights, disabilities, poetry, and music. What is your vision for your work as a whole?
Wow. To use the power of sculptures of the human figure, the human body, actual people, to convey abstract ideas that are very important to the human spirit.
You mentioned the FDR Hope Memorial is still in progress. And I wonder if you can touch on the trials and tribulations of doing commissions, especially large public ones, because I believe, you know, that a lot of different groups are involved in the FDR sculpture, and, you know, then elections have happened, and there are issues with getting paid, and there are issues with the piece taking up a lot of space in the studio. Where can you shed light about, I guess, the risks, the tribulations, the difficulty of doing this kind of work?
Wow. Well, there are tribulations are part of it. I once had the pleasure of speaking with Neil Estern, who was a president of the National Sculpture Society and did the sculpture of FDR for the memorial in Washington and a statue of LaGuardia that's down on LaGuardia Place. And it's just a wonderful sculptor. And I believe he's in his late 80s now. And I asked him about the 20 years that he waited to fulfill that commission in Washington, working on models, dealing with committees. And I told him that I was getting involved in public art commissions, and he said, "You're young, you can take it." So I'm not that young, but I can still take it. And it is quite complex. It involves dealing with other people and being very sensitive to other people. And that's something I couldn't do when I was young and learned to do throughout my 20s and 30s. But that's a really fascinating part of it. One of the things I've learned with committees is that the relationship can never become adversarial. It's really a collaboration in spirit. And they also that they may want contradictory things. For instance, in Boston, they wanted an undisputedly contemporary artwork, but they also wanted it to be in harmony with this beautiful 19th century environment, the street with no stores, no advertising, with a statue on every block except this one. And you could practically imagine people with carriages and horses going up and down the street. And I solved that with a kind of conceptual twist, maybe a touch of humor that made it undisputedly contemporary and still let me use statues and statuary and all of the great tradition and power of that. So, and then the committee may have, or the commission may be forced something very kitschy or even sentimental as a concept. FDR with a little girl, you know, shaking hands or greeting each other. But there is a huge opportunity there to make something much more profound happen. And some of that comes from the committee. A lot of it comes out of interacting with them and sometimes, usually they won't pay extra if you want to make great art out of a kitschy idea, but sometimes it does. I did a large plaque for the AFL, so sponsored by the AFL-CIO, for the Massachusetts State House, commemorating a labor leader who was kind of accidentally shot by a maniac in the governor's office, and turned it into a history of the labor movement in Massachusetts, which is really the labor movement in the United States. And they were delighted with this, and they raised additional money. And the plaque is 3 feet by 5 feet. It's large, and they had really envisioned something much smaller. So that can happen. More tribulations?
If you like, yeah.
Well, please jump in with questions.
I think this... I wonder how this goes to the issue of managing projects overall, because the way you describe it sounds a lot like managing a corporate IT project. There's a scope of the project. There's a need for some really clear objectives on the part of the stakeholders. You describe them as stakeholders. It's a very business-like approach.
Yes.
And then, of course, you know, in corporate life, there's the project triangle, the three sides. You can have it fast, right, or cheap, but you only get to pick two of those. And so there's balancing sort of the expectations for the final outcome. To what degree do you find that managing projects is a real part of your work as a business, as an artist, and what are the challenges that brings up for you?
Yes, it's a huge part. And I'm very lucky to have my husband work as my project manager. He's an independent filmmaker. He's a writer and director. He's about to direct the premiere of an opera. And I've worked on many of his films, and he's worked on many of my sculpture projects. But he has a brain for logistics and for business in the purest sense, what people's expectations are underlying what they say, what they're going to expect you to do, even if they didn't think of it, tell you, remind you, etc., what your obligations are and when. And he helps me make schedules and stick to them and keep track of every aspect of this, really. Initially, I was not comfortable with contracts and record keeping, but I've become so. And it's really not that hard if you're not afraid of it. But it's a switch for an artist to be thinking about what 20 other people might need or want. Not that I'm thinking about that while I'm in the studio working with the clay, but the rest of the time, there's a lot of it to be kept track of. It's different from corporation, perhaps, because the stakeholders know that they want something grand. They want it to commemorate a specific person or idea. But beyond that, they don't know that they want it to be pointing in this direction or that direction, or be so many feet high, or have a lot of gesture, or be very still, or any of the specific sculpture issues. That's what I introduce them to and get them involved in. And I come up with an idea and then defend it.
Well, I think I almost think that there is a lot of overlap with, you know, I've worked in corporate project management for Fortune 500 companies. And of course, I do a lot of project management now in my other business as an external marketing director for other people's companies. Mm-hmm. And in one of the things I observe is that no one knows what they really want if you force them to give you an exact picture. They have some parameters, they have some ideas. And in that sense, all project management is art. But I think you're making a very huge observation that I don't think a lot of people think of going in, which is that if you want to do large projects, it does require a professionalized approach to project management, because otherwise you are not going to be able to keep that balance of scope, objectives, managing perceptions. And so I think that's one of the brilliant keys to your success.
I don't think of it as professional. I just think of it as intensely hands-on, with a lot of discussions going on here in our home all the time. And then what passes between us and the committee is very carefully considered, very strategic, very calm, unless we need to be agitated for a reason. But all the Sturm und Drang is here at home. What do they mean? And how can they, you know, how can they undermine me in this way? And all of these tantrums are at home. And then you realize, oh, the sculpture isn't smiling enough, or something. There's some reason in the work for what is going on. Or there's a bureaucracy that you simply haven't penetrated. You don't understand what a committee needs in order to report to the community board, or what the community board needs in order to report to the city. There's always layers to uncover as to how bureaucracies and institutions and cities work. So we're just very wary.
Let me ask you what this tells us about contracts. When you think about the contract that you've entered into at the beginning versus where you have to go with the scope of the project, are there any lessons or takeaways, or is there any advice or information you can sort of give people who are interested in doing this kind of work, or even people who are interested in commissioning this kind of work, about what has to go into the contract and how it needs to be structured?
That's very technical, and I think it probably should vary from project to project. But it's important to structure the artist's payments based on stages of the work and not on time, so that, you know, it's not like you should be paid in June. It's that you should be paid when this is complete, so that if you need more time, you can talk to them and get it if it's absolutely necessary. Or if you finish sooner, that kind of thing needs to be thought about. Also, I think it's important to break things into stages for other reasons. I once gave a job to a foundry, and partway in had to face the fact that it should have been obvious from the start that this foundry could not complete the work on time and well, and leaving me sane and functional. There were just too many stressors and too many unprofessional things going on. And I tried to take the job away from them, but we had a contract, and I did, in the end, take the job and go to a better foundry, and it was beautifully finished. But I had to pay a fee, and I had to go through about a year of craziness, starting pieces over in another location. And had I broken that contract into stages, I would have been better off, because I could have stopped the work in the middle. I simply didn't know that. I now work with foundries that I know and trust, people that I've really gotten to know. And some of that you simply learn by experience, by screwing up and doing it better next time. It's helpful to take advice from other sculptors and really listen to them. There were people who warned me against using that initial foundry, and other people who said it was great. But, you know, if you get enough feedback, that may help.
I think that's a brilliant aspect of project management, is that, you know, it consists of project milestones. And so what you're saying is building that into the contract, and getting paid, really importantly, getting paid on the basis of project milestones is really important. And then also building in provisions for third-party dependencies. When a third party lets you down, you know, a lot of contracts provide for that, that, you know, the exposure, the liability changes, the scope may, the time for deliverables may change based on the responsibility, the inevitable responsibility of a third party. So I think that's wise advice.
Okay, but there's an important distinction. I've never done a commission where I would have sued anybody. I just got a large chunk of money on the current commission that was due 2.5 years ago. And there was really nothing to be done. We were doing everything we could. I was helping fundraising. My sister was helping with fundraising. It simply took this long to get that money. So there was no one from whom I could have wrung it by legal means. There was no way to say, oh, you owe me this money and I must have it, because the money wasn't there to be had. Nor would I have gone after it in that way. It didn't make any sense. But I wouldn't have taken a commission working with people who I distrusted or disliked, or who I wouldn't have done it just a job just for money and gotten myself into that situation.
Doesn't it go to the responsibility of the artist too? Because someone has contracted, there's the other party, there's the stakeholders, and yet you're sort of waiting on a third party dependency. So I know that in my business contracts, I build in clauses that say, look, you know, I'm responsible to a point, but in the end, if a third party does not deliver, sure, we can replace them, but it may delay the project.
Yeah.
And it's designed to minimize my exposure, you know. Well, so what does, What does all this, these struggles with these really large commissions, what does this tell us about the actual fee for the commission and the, you know, the what you, how to know what to charge, and then the size of work that artists undertake? So for instance, is there advice that you would give if you were to talk to a 20-something artist who was setting out to do a commission of size for the first time? You know, what do you wish you'd known that you would tell them about what to charge and what, you know, what, where to go first for making sure you're not going to run into so many tribulations?
Well, I think first of all, you are going to run into tribulation. So try to have fun with them. Try to treat it as an adventure, because this is, you're reinventing the wheel with every commission, and you should be. If you're doing public sculpture and it's the same thing every time, that's not, for me, that would not make life worth living. I want it to be very new and different each time. And for instance, the one I'm working on now, the figures are physically relating to each other. In the Boston Women's Memorial, there are three figures at a distance from each other, and the viewer kind of compares them and puts them together in their mind. They're not actually conversing. So it's an advance artistically to have figures actually about to touch and looking into each other's eyes and communicating. And it's much more difficult. It's scary and thrilling. So that's part of it. It's going to be an adventure. And the business stuff will be an adventure. You have to have a couple of basic skills. You're going to get paid in chunks, hopefully large chunks, but very sporadically. And you have to be able to figure out how to spend that money when you don't know how long it's supposed to last. You can't really make a budget and stick to it like someone with a paycheck. So one of the things that we always try to do is spend a little of that money on work and future work, invest it back into the work. I just updated my website after something like 5 years of saying, I've got to update my website, because the money wasn't there. And last year I got paid for something, and we did that. But the biggest skill is not to panic. I think it's important to do this because you love doing it, and because you want the object you're creating, the project you're doing, to exist in the real world long after you're gone. And so it's always important to do your very best work, even if they're not paying you enough, even if you're not getting those checks. It's still important. I did a temporary sculpture for a show here in New York City that was on the rooftop of a YMCA for a year. And then I got it back. And I had a mold made. It's a big bas relief. It's 5 feet by 6 feet, all of a kind of humorous variations on growing up. Still growing up. So there's children with animals and all kinds of other things going on in it. And I made a mold, and I have sold 5 copies of it. Oh, and I was paid $200. Sorry, that was the stipend. And then for some reason, they gave me an additional $200. And I exhibited the original. But then I had a mold made, and I sold 5 copies of it. And the last copy I sold to a children's hospital for $12,000. And I have a few more copies in my studio. So that's my biggest financial success over, you know, from a preposterous beginning, you know, $200 for something I worked on for months. So, but because it's beautiful and funny and covetable, people want to buy it. So that, you know, you have to do that too. You can't always gauge, you can't always say, oh, I'm only getting $1,000 for this, so I'm only going to do 6 weeks or 3 weeks, or I'm only going to do X number of hours. You have to say, I'm getting $1,000 for this, but it really should look like such and such. And I've always wanted to do such and such, so I'm going to do it. And some, you know, we'll eat rice for 6 months or whatever. And it will come back. It will build your ability. It will build your career. And it will build your spirit to work like that. Doesn't make a lot of sense business-wise. But I don't think this is a business. Yeah, it's not a job, and it's not really a business. It's a way of life. So it's also important to accept whatever money comes. You know, if you have a relative you don't get along with who gives you money, take the money. Or if you have somebody paying you a preposterous amount for a small amount of work, let them overpay you, you know, but feed it back into the stuff that you should be doing.
So it's not a job, it's a career, and it's a mission. I think The thing I like best about what you said is the biggest skill is not to panic. So let me ask you, you know, what about, you know, is it different being a sculptor? You know, you obviously do other things. You are interested in poetry and music and writing. But do sculptures face special issues in creating large public works that maybe other visual artists like a painter do not necessarily?
Yes. Well, there are many physical issues. The stuff is harder to move around. It's physically harder to create. You need help with it. Although I did build large cement sculptures, a bowl at a time, basically without any help. But it took me months and months and months. And it's much more satisfying to have a commission where you can work in clay and work fairly speedily and build up the form. But still, I hire people to help me build armatures, to help engineer the way the thing comes apart or gets put back together so you can work on inaccessible areas. There's a lot of engineering to it, but most of that is very well known, and some of it is very ancient. Bronze casting is a very ancient process, although it's been wonderfully updated with technology. It's kind of high-tech now. It's also very low-tech and takes many people many hours to produce a statue. Whereas a painting, I'm sure there are a lot of technical issues, but essentially it's lighter. It weighs less. There's also with work that's designed to go outdoors, you need to create ownership. You need people to want to take care of it, to want to come and wash and wax it every year, to protect it. In Boston, that was amazing. People would put flowers by one of the statues, and other people would come and put them in the fingers of the other statues. Before the first snowfall, somebody put a sweater on the Lucy Stone figure and left it there. And it was kind of a joke, but it was beautiful. And then a Boston Red Sox cap on Phyllis Wheatley, and more flowers. There was a guy who somebody caught, you know, they knew who he was, who would come and write derogatory, misogynist stuff in chalk, thank God, in chalk, on the memorial. And when he was spotted, people just said, you can't do this. And I don't know if they succeeded in making him feel ashamed, but they got him to stop doing it. And I'm glad the sculptures were powerful enough that they brought out that kind of emotion. And I'm glad it was only chalk. So yeah, all of that. There's a lot of technical, physical stuff going on with sculpture.
So let me ask you something in a different direction. Do you think that biases about genre, you know, the type of sculpture, the type of painting, the school of art in which it falls, whether that has to do with time, it's contemporary or traditional, it has to do with, you know, whether it's abstract or extremely abstract or realist or whatever. Do you think that genre biases, have an impact in keeping artists from reaching their potential, either genre biases among those that commission the work, or among those, among the artists themselves or their constituents?
No, the biases certainly exist, but you just have to go somewhere else. You just have to find the other people who want the kind of work that you do, because there are plenty of commissions now for the kind of work I do. There weren't when I was in art school, and in fact, I didn't look at statuary in the 1970s. I was at Cooper Union. We were doing conceptual art. The sculpture department was post-structuralism and Marxism, conceptual art. And nobody went to look at the gorgeous sculpture outside the Plaza Hotel by Augusta St. Gaudens, the Sherman Memorial, with the Angel of Victory and Sherman on his horse looking so fierce. But it's all gorgeous, abstract, curving rhythms in that. It's just a beautifully thought out piece of sculpture. And our class could have gone and somebody could have spoken for 45 minutes about why it works and what it means and why it was said, but nobody looked at them. Those works were invisible then. And I remember going to the Metropolitan Museum and trying to buy a book on Daniel Chester French and another one on, and they didn't have them. They didn't have St. Gaudens in the bookstore. And then a few years ago, they had a big exhibit of his work. So times change, tastes change. But even, I think, especially now, actually, you can find people who want gigantic steel abstractions that move in the wind or that are static, that are shiny or dull, that are painted, you know, but you can also find people who want a statue of a civic leader or a humorous Botero-like big blumpy, you know, Henry Moore figure, or the field is kind of open, I think. So I don't think, when I say no, I don't think it will stunt anybody's growth. I think you just have to look around harder.
How has motherhood influenced your work?
Well, it's made me very much more realistic about scheduling. I now think of my studio as a factory. I don't think of it as a contemplative space. When I go there, I know how many hours I have. I get to work. And I used to putter around and do what I call circling. You know, I'd make a cup of tea, I do this, I do that. In my studio, I only do that if I'm tired and I need to sit down for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, then back to work, because I have X hours plus transportation, and then I have to be home. So time management has just become clearer. But I've had a tremendously adventurous and exciting time as a mother. My son has autism. And although he was born with speech, he stopped communicating and then learned to communicate again at age 12 by pointing to letters. And the first time he referred to me as mom, which he had never done, was pretty amazing. And he now has opinions about my work. He has made sculptures with me. He loves Florence and Renaissance art. He keeps begging to be taken there again. And some of that I must come from me, but it's really a thrilling thing to be a mother. So I'm glad.
I have two more questions. One is, what was your initial marketing strategy when you first started out as a sculptor, and how has it evolved to the present day?
Well, when I first started out, I had no marketing strategy. I was so busy learning, because when I was in art school, as I was saying, I didn't learn the skills that I needed. I didn't learn anatomy. I didn't have sculpture working from a live model. There was a bronze foundry. That's how I became a sculptor in art school. And I made little surrealistic, funny things out of wax. But when I came to do the human figure, my professor, who was a wonderful artist, would say, oh, you don't need to study anatomy, because it was the mid-70s. So my strategy was just to study as much as I could and learn as much as I could and make things and try to get shows. And gradually I got excited about outdoor sculpture possibilities. And I think this was before the internet. So I would find listings in magazines. Also, the New York City Percent for Art was then functioning, and they would send out mailing pieces with opportunities. And I just started applying. And I did many, many, many proposals before I got anywhere. So a business plan was really to keep trying and keep learning.
If you could have one superpower or technology to do something that you're currently not able to do with your art and career, what would that be?
Oh, wow. Maybe the fountain of youth. it's harder, you know. The body ages, the eyes age. Be nice to recover as quickly as I did when I was in my 20s. I would like to be able to visit the past, not to interact, but just to listen and look and see what ancient temples looked like, ancient cities crowded with statuary, what Renaissance Florence looked like, and many other things.
That sounds like a fun superpower.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about the future. I think I might not want to visit that and just leave it up to other people.
Well, ideally, the future is populated with many more of your works, and of course...
Well, a few more, yes, I hope. Many more works, but good ones, I hope. My aspiration is always to make something better than the idea I start out with. You know, more beautiful, more powerful. And hopefully in less time.
You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on the fund, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. For more information on Meredith Bergman, visit meredithbergman.com and be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Meredith. It's been really great having you.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.